poet for the Poetry Center this semester. But there's a great deal of activity going on in the next few weeks. Our last reading will be a week from tonight in the Terrace Lounge of the Student Union, and it will honor the undergraduate students whose work has been accepted for Persona magazine. An Israeli poet, Ada Aharoni, is visiting the campus under the sponsorship of the Hillel Foundation and is doing some readings tomorrow. I put some sheets advertising her readings on the refreshment table in the hall. Also, Friday night of this week is the night of women's poetry, 8 o'clock in the Student Union Junior Ballroom, and I put some sheets about it on the table, too. In addition to our reading next week, the English department is sponsoring a reading by Gary Holthouse. And that's Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock, Student Union 283. Pima College is sponsoring a reading Thursday night by Jim Zimmerman, fine young poet who teaches at Northern Arizona University. On Easter Sunday, Steve Orlin and Tony Hoagland will be reading at the Dinnerware Artist Cooperative Gallery at 7:30 in the evening. It's in conjunction with a showing of paintings and pastels by Gail Marcus Orlin. The second Tucson Poetry Festival will be the last weekend of the month. That's April 27, 28, and 29. I brought over a stack of our last newsletter because, in case you didn't get it, there is an article about the Tucson Poetry Festival in that. And it gives a number where you can get more information. And a very special performance is being done by the University of Arizona Readers Theater, a chamber theater production of C.E. Pulverman's novel, Solomon's Daughter. And that will be next Friday and Saturday night at the U of A Theater. Now, there will be a short quiz. All that. It's a great pleasure to have Henry Carlisle here, and I hope you can stay after the reading and meet him, have some refreshments. He's published two collections of poetry, The Rough-Hewn Table with the University of Missouri Press and Running Lights with Dragon Gate Press. His work appears in many magazines and anthologies. Since 1967, he's been associated with Portland State University. His honors include a National Endowment for the Arts Discovery Grant, a Devins Award, a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, and PEN Syndicated Fiction Award. You have a great treat in store for you listening to Henry Carlisle.
Can you all hear me okay? The sound of all right? I thought I'd start with the poem which was on the announcement, the flyer. In Portland, I went flying with a neighbor of ours who has a light plane, and he let me fly it. We were flying at night. I had flown light planes before with other friends. I liked to do it. And this poem is about the experience of looking down, trying to discover which house was ours, knowing that my wife and daughter would be down there someplace. Flying. Sometimes late at night, dozing over a book, the fire low, and the wind high outside. I hear above the moon in the wires the lonely motor of a small plane, and I wonder who's up there, or if, through the overcast, he sees our lights and can find his way safely down the blue runway. I have been there once or twice, hunched over red instruments, intent on some horizon at an unfelt altitude. How slowly the night passed beneath my wings. yet the airspeed indicator read written too. One of those lights down there was home, small, indistinguishable in the darkness, and someone pointing, the star that moves, that's your father. Thought I'd go back to an older poem, which I stopped reading for a while because I got tired of it, but I've started reading it again because since Jerry Falwell and others of his persuasion have been so vocal, it seemed a right time to read this poem. It's about my grandmother. She had a religious conversion of the low church order after having had 13 children, and which makes that kind of suspect, doesn't it? But she threw my grandfather out of the house. She was a very difficult woman. After this poem first appeared in the book, I got a letter from a woman down in a little town called Glide, Oregon. And she was concerned because she felt that I was godless and I needed saving. And she wrote me this very concerned letter and sent me a lot of religious literature. And I wrote back to her and I said, I'm not against religion, I'm against fanaticism. And she sent me a whole bunch more. Grandmother. No one remembered when she first discovered God. Her conversion was sudden as a slammed door. Outside, my grandfather beat the door jamb with his fist, but she, God furious, would not relent. Shut up like an oyster on a speck of dirt, she praised God in her bedclothes, read the Bible like a French novel, and dreamed each night of Christ the Savior, the lightning bolt of revelation forking at her from the black cloud of her Bible, and the Godhead stirring inside her like a sick sea. Overnight, her skirts grew longer and her temper shorter. The black buttons on her boots crept higher and higher on legs that had never seen the light. Whenever she rode the cable car downtown, she pulled her bonnet tight around her ears to let no evil word hiss through. Her eyes magnified by scripture, split by the seeing lens and reading lens, which could never look together. Beholders of two worlds, one black and one white, negative, censored, and unprintable. A damned world bleached of color. Stern as an iron stove, she drove her children off to church, beat their bottoms with a willow to make them kneel like 13 sinful recalcitrant, flagellant, bleeding at the altars, pinched upright in their pews, reciting alphabets of sin, while the preacher, a red-faced Russian with a beard as black as God, gospeled from the pulpit, and the congregation flapped their tongues, prophesying improbable forgiveness. But nothing ever was. The family scattered out like rabbits from the sawed-off shotgun of the true faith, while grandmother rocked in the cradle of belief, reading and praying, copying scriptures on tiny scraps of paper that peep like mice or children from every nook and cranny of the old house, from cookie jars and table drawers and kitchen cupboards, even from the Bible itself, marsupial with misconceptions threatening every minute to explode, until one day her heart did, and we hunkered in the shadow of her death, a bad luck come to nothing family, wrong census. This next poem is from the same book, my first book, The Ruffian Table, and it's a request. I'm going to dedicate this one to my friend John Anderson, who asked me to read it. And I'm only going to read part of the poem. If I had to write this poem over again, I'd revise a lot of the first part of it. But it came out of an experience, in part at least, which is described in the poem, but also from a couple of quotations that at the time meant quite a bit to me. One is from Luke I believe it's chapter 11, verse 34, if I'm not mistaken. The quotation is, "The light of the body is the eye. Therefore, when thine eye is single, thy whole body is full of light. But when thine eye is evil, thy body also is full of darkness." And also from a quotation which seems similar, from a letter of Van Gogh's to his brother Theo, which goes, "Let us pray that our eye may become single, and then our whole body shall be full of light." And this is the third and fourth section of the poem. It's titled Narcissus, a Notebook. Midway between the hugest red star, the smallest electron, I can't turn my eyes from this world and don't want to. Flowers and novas, snowflakes and diatoms, observable and immeasurable explosions of species, brief love affairs and words confuse me, looking for with a mind in chaos, considering all the physical evidence of a fear, letting the light fall past my hearing, letting the eye mislead the eye. That afternoon, we walked through the Badlands and saw the earth forgetting itself and believed in those scars, believed weather might reveal us. And in the Wind River Canyon, in a lightning storm, we saw the same colors, only this time more intense, and stopping to look, found the red shafted flicker trapped in a ball of line with a fish hook through its leg. Together we held it and cut the hook free, then watched it fly off between lightning breaks. Coming back from the river, where I'd washed the blood from my hands, I found the dried remains of a young kingfisher, ants crawling from its eye sockets. Didn't tell you. That night in the Tetons, I lay awake with my hands over my eyes. Clouds filled all the mountains. Part 4. After they had prepared his funeral pyre, they turned and found where his body had been, a flower of gold with white-rimmed petals. Narcissus, Narcissus, we are what we long for. Now you are everywhere in spring, under trees and flowering shrubs, among ground cover plantings, near water, in rock gardens and patios, or in borders by secret pathways, or naturalized in sweeping drifts, wherever light and space are available. When I was very young, we lived in Seattle. My mother was always getting married and divorced. She married four times, which is a little confusing for me, at least. But at the time that this poem refers to, we were living in Seattle, and they had street photographers then who would take your photograph and then hand you a card. And you could, send them 25 cents or whatever it was then, and it was very inexpensive, and get your photo. They weren't very good, just snapshots. But there was one of my mother and myself that I'm especially fond of. I was being very bad that day. I had a little wooden sword, and I was really, I guess I was about 5 years old then, maybe. And I had been cutting up rather badly, and my mother was very cross. And at the moment that the photo was taken, passing under a theater marquee, and I thought that the titles of the films were rather funny. The poem is titled Grace, which is my mother's name. You look away as though to pretend you can't see the man aiming at us. He must have stood for hours, focusing, shooting, holding out his card, perhaps having already decided who should pass and who stop. Why are you dressed all in black? You were never religious. No one has died. You told me past the theater, errant night, feet skipping off the pavement. How famous we seem with that caption above our heads. Two big features, the grapes of wrath of mice and men. After all these years, I seem to see us reversed. I, the little angry mother, and you, the son, unruly as always, aiming sword down the camera's muzzle, that breath fixed in burning, that petrifying light. The Grapes of Wrath was one of my mother's favorite films, and she took me to see it three times when I was a little kid, and I hated it. I thought it was the most depressing film I'd ever seen. Of course, I love it now, and I understand why my mother liked it. It meant a lot to her, and it described some of her life to her, I think. You know, she drifted around the country looking for work, much the way Steinbeck's characters did. Anyway, I, in part, had that landscape in my mind. I don't know why the Midwestern landscape has meant a lot to me. We had a horrendous trip from Minnesota out to California once, which was like a replay of the Grapes of Wrath. And it was during the Second World War, and we went through two cars out there when you couldn't buy tires or anything. It was awful. But in some way, this poem is about fathers, I guess, but also about that period. A lot of the imagery is about that period. It's titled Depression. He is pushing a black Ford through an empty street, a car like his father's that beat the flat roads like wind in summer and brought him here. He never forgave his father. That was the year he left home. Then there was talk of weather, and everyone was packing. Windmills were stopped all over Kansas. He is thinking of fathers, the ways they never forgive you, withholding love like lust. But they quit. They stop like pumps. There is no way to set them working again. He is thinking of mothers, how she could not know how he have followed girls down darts of his heart, how that loneliness is passed to sons, to the fathers of sons. He is pushing a black Ford. Its problem is such a heart you cannot give it enough care. Like a father, it will quit, and there is no end to this. My real father was Spanish. He was born in Havana. And Carlisle is my adopted name. When I went to get a passport once, I had a lot of trouble with the passport agency because when I presented them my birth certificate with my real father's name, which was Prieto on it, and it said born in Havana, and boy, that was enough. never mind that he... I haven't seen him since I was 2 years old. But I started this poem in free verse. It's titled Havana Blues. And it seemed to want to go into couplets. And even though it seemed to me that some of the rhymes in it were terribly obvious, I thought I'd just go with them and see where it went. And I left it this way in couplets. There's a senator alluded to in here. It was Senator Eugene McCarthy. The right McCarthy. Tonight I thought of you as I smoked a cigar smuggled in from your birthplace by a senator who gave it to a friend who gave it to me. Why speak as though to someone I could see? I tried to know why fathers leave their sons. Why it is easy to forget. It must be, when you've never written me to say you're well, if you're alive, and wish me well, would like to visit when you have a chance. Were you too proud or grieved? The evidence suggests you were, and so I understand and must forgive. If you would only send a card to say, hello again, your father, but I'm talking to myself, why bother? You might be dead for all I know or care. I care, and yet I must confess my fear is finding you, not knowing what to say. I'm talking to myself, a game I play with words. Your face, the paper that I press, blank, father, ghost. And if I miss you now, I miss for both of us, at two, a small, imperfect replica of you. I read this poem in one of the classes last night. I hope you'll forgive me if I read it again. It's titled Spider Reeves. And it has a reference in it to Damascus Twist, which is a kind of tobacco, but also a kind of steel that shotgun barrels used to be made out of. It's an annealed kind of wire, which is wound in a spiral. And it was designed for use with black powder. And smokeless powder shotgun loads used to have warnings written on them that they shouldn't be used in Damascus Twist barrels. Well, my friend who had a shotgun, a double-barreled shotgun, one barrel of which worked, did it and got away with it. He was always taking chances. And I knew that one day he would die young. He did. He went out, he was a commercial fisherman, and he went out on Gray's Harbor in a storm when all the other fishermen were sitting at the dock playing poker, and everyone told him not to go out, and he went out anyway, got outside the breakwater and saw it was too rough and turned his boat around and started to come in, and he broached and drowned. But unfortunately, a lot of these misadventures, which are described in this poem, are ones that I was involved with, and they scared hell out of me. Spider Reeves. But for the broken firing pin, would it have lived elsewhere? You could have blown it out with your breath, poked it out with a stick, but you liked to see its many eyes gleam from the chamber each time you opened it. The next door chamber took in noisy tenants, threw them out. What the spider thought of that loud eviction, it next door to death, no more a damned fool than you. Smokeless powder, Damascus Twist, lucky you didn't poach your own head instead of the deer's. One night you shot at eyes and fetched a scream so shrill you thought it was a woman's. It was a ring-tailed coon's. Who else but you would plug a punctured gas tank with a match, patch a leaking boat with gum, get lost in fog on an ebb tide with the wind building? In school, they called you spider, not for the spider in your gun, but because you snagged passes with your sticky hands, running so many directions at once, it seemed you had eight legs. Now you run with the tide, so many lost molecules, a gleam in the dog shark's eye, a diatomaceous spark. You were not very bright. You could have learned to live. My third stepfather, I do lose track sometimes, was probably more of a father to me than anyone. My mother finally found a man she could be happy with and has stayed with him for many, many years. But several years ago, he had a terrible accident with a propane gas tank, which has exploded in their camping trailer. And he had a bad burn, 40% burn, first, second, and third degree burn. And since he was very old, it's rather dangerous. There are all kinds of side effects from burns, as you know. But I used to have a very happy dream about my stepfather. I alluded to it once in my first book. I'd have a dream that he wrote an absolutely perfect book of poems, a small selected poems. Like, and it always made me terrifically happy because it would be like one of those dreams where you have a big house, you know, and you forgot all the rooms that are in it, and you find a little room in it that you're happy in, you know. I would forget that my stepfather had done this marvelous thing, and then I would remember it. And it was always great. But then when this accident happened, I finally deciphered the dream. I realized what the green book was. And I've never had the dream since, and it really bothers me because it was a happy dream. I wish it would come back. Anyway, the poem is titled The Book of the Deer, the Bear, and the Elk. You never wrote the small green book like the poems of Edward Thomas. It was a book I dreamed. But watching the green report of your heart on the monitor, it came to me as I stood like one of the doctors in my cap and gown. Home, where you've lived like a bachelor at the far end of the house, there is a green diary, the book of the deer, the bear, and the elk, with snapshots of Julian and Bob and Harry, old hunting friends dead as the game strung up on poles or drooped across fenders. I think you are the only one left, and still you fight to stay, breathing the scorched air of the burn ward, the sweet stink of your own charred flesh. Stepfather, don't go. 73 years is not the end of the book, the letters you never wrote, because even before you blistered your hands, the act of writing pained you. It took 4 shots to bring it down. Your father never praised you. Rising dinner that night, he beckoned toward the woodshed where the skinned deer hung draped in burlap. Then he whipped you with a belt. Don't ever bring home meat shot up like that. One bullet is enough. I saw you kill a running buck at 300 yards with 1 shot. It's a brutal art that fathers pass to sons. When the propane tank ignited, you took the flaming cylinder in your arms like a lover and fought it out the door. Now you dream each night of the trailer burning. My mother screams and beats the fire out of her hair. She was not burned like you, twice and 3 times for your care. Now the deer are safe from us. I have 1 photograph to add to our book, a doe running through a field, my best shot. Somewhere in the grass behind her, a fawn is hiding. You can't see it, but it's waiting for its mother to draw us away. Later, she'll return, and the 2 of them will be saved. Stepfather, father, be like the fawn. I used to write a lot of bird poems, and I was explaining this in class the other night, because I couldn't seem to write directly about experiences. I was too shy, so I would pick some ridiculous looking bird. Like a coot or a blue heron or something, and write about that. And it sort of expressed, it became a sort of a metaphor for a certain stage that I was going through. And it was inevitable, I guess, that I would write a poem about the dodo, the extinct dodo. I really empathize with the dodo sometimes. It was a big, dumb pigeon, you know, and it had no chance. And there's a sad story about the dodo. There is no complete dodo any place in the world. You know, they have stuffed passenger pigeons, I think, and other species that have gone extinct. But they have no complete dodos. They make up replicas of them, you know, what they look like. They have pieces of dodos. But they don't have enough pieces to put them all together and make one dodo. See, right? Anyway, After I wrote this poem, a friend sent me one of the stamps, you know. It was a lovely stamp. It's one of my favorite. It says, "Save the dodo before it's too late." Dodo. Years they mistook me for you, chanting your name in the streets, pointing grubby fingers. Today in the Natural History Museum, I saw why. Dodo, you look the way I feel, with your sad, absent-minded eyes and your beak like a Stone Age axe. Even your feathers, dingy and fuzzy, what woman would want them for a hat? With a name like Didus Ineptus, where could you go? Wings too small to fly with, and feet so large and slow. You were not very palatable. Men slaughtered you for sport. Hogs ate the one egg you laid each year. Sometimes I think I know how it feels to be scattered over the world, a foot in the British Museum, a head in Copenhagen, to be a lesson after the fact, an entity in name only, and that taken in vain. Poor Dodo. In Oregon, there's a... I've always been interested in eccentric hermits, you know, of various kinds. There was one that called John Turno, who lived near where I did as a child, who ran off into the Olympic Peninsula and became a wild man. And they hunted him for years, and, you know, after he had killed a bunch of people who had tried to capture him. And they finally, you know, shot him. And he was one of those local mythic people who became a legend. I've alluded to him also to hermit I knew, who was a terrible smelling old hermit. He would come out of the woods every once in a while to buy supplies. Everybody called him Posy Flowers. I don't think that was his real name, however. But the other one that most recently who has interested me is called the Birdman of Redmond. And they first did a local series on him. And then later he was on one of those awful television shows like Faces and Places, or Real People, I guess it was. And but he has some marvelous gift with birds. For some reason, they trust him, and he can walk outside his old trailer and just say, hear birds," and they come for miles around and land all over him. He's been fighting a long battle with some companies to build a rock crusher, and he's been fighting this single-handed battle to try to keep them away because he's afraid they'll scare away all his birds. Anyway, I wrote this poem about him, and then not having ever seen him except on television, and then and guessing about some things. Later, Kim Stafford, William Stafford's son, went to visit him and wrote an article on him. And I found, I said, well, I hope he's never read this poem, because there are a couple of things in it that might hurt his feelings. You know, like something about filthy, you know. And I didn't know if that were true or not. I thought it was. But Kim said, yeah, he really is. He smells awful, but he's a nice man. Anyway. The Birdman of Redmond. He will not be told the rock crusher's legal weight, or why the courts consider the rights of birds worth less than gravel or money. Therefore, he may stand a few more days with his arms spread in the clearing, crying, hear birds, as the flocks gather for crumbs. I have known others like him, filthy, kindly men, living alone, friends to deer and chipmunk, no longer able to speak sensibly of the world outside, though they babble to anyone who comes. One, I heard, took to the trees and was found years later, his face chewed by rats. Some swore him a genius wronged in politics or love. Sometimes I think there is in each of us a simple place with its fire, a place of refusals to forget whatever we came here for, a face, no matter, surely some awful failure. Some call it the self. We must lure as slowly as the eyes that come each night to circle the fire. Most never find it. I have dreamed such a place for years, a room I had almost forgotten in a house so huge it was hard to remember each room and hallway. I want so much to believe in it, because I know that others have seen it too, or some such place. There are too many rock crushers, too many tempers that break every hardness but our own. Just once I'd like some gentleness to win. It may not, which is why we have these places in ourselves, these rooms we barely remember. Well, time to read some new poems. These are recent, written since Running Lights. The first one I'll read is titled The Cloud and the Plow and the Meaning of Rhyme. And it's kind of a playful response to something that my wife wrote once. It was an essay that she wrote that interested me a lot about why we write in lines, you know, because we plow fields in straight lines and so on. It was kind of an interesting organic theory of poetry. Something about the poetry coming naturally out of experience and sort of arranging itself. And I believe there's a great deal of truth in that. But I started writing this poem late one night and I guess playing with the language and just having a lot of fun with it. You think the cloud will come closer and make everything clear. That's what you think. But it is elsewhere, making someone else rain. The man in the cloud-colored suit cannot undertake his own shadow. It follows like a dog of rhyme. He puts out the light, and he is everywhere, a shadow in the shadows. He turns on the light, his shadow starts from him like gray business. Why did you start this enterprise of rain? The reasons for rhyme are everywhere. You were not thinking of unplowing the fields. You'd like the furrows to refrain like a concentration of exact foreheads all nodding as one, the bell calling every man to mass on the same note, an absolute disaster. Grief that embezzles and runs, spending from rill to rill, bringing on blades, helping the hogs that pour from their pens in your own pet grasshopper. All new. And yet there is some precedent for this. As after great thunder and sin, you feel refreshed. As after hard rain, you see the steam rising from fields and hear the birds starting up all over again, their fierce little engines. Strange, you even knew they could sing. A gay friend of mine that I like a lot confessed to me with a characteristic self-irony that he felt himself to be in an untenable situation. He was getting old and fat, and he's still hopelessly addicted to athletic young men. So I wrote a poem for him titled Keeper of the Towels. Which is really a spin-off. It's a derivation from a Rilke poem. It's written in form. So it's titled Keeper of the Towels after Rilke. His sight from ever peering through the showers has grown so keen he thinks of little else, and he is always present like the evening hours to shyly seek what elevates his pulse. Thigh, shoulder, calf, or thrilling bum, divine torsos of Larry, Bruce, and Butchie, he calms himself by dosing up on Valium, fearful to be forward might prove touchy. His loitering bespeaks a hidden poignant need in which the will to act stands paralyzed. Careless, do they know what lusts they feed, so easy in themselves, so idolized? A couple of summers ago, I was teaching at the Centrum Foundation in Washington, and after the conference, I decided to go salmon fishing. And while I was fishing, I saw a Poseidon-class submarine coming up the straits. I didn't know what it was at first, because you can see the black conning tower on one of those things for miles. It looks like the dorsal of a killer whale. And that is in water where there are a lot of killer whales. And I ran my boat at it and flew a band the Trident flag. This was a month before the USS Ohio came in. It didn't seem right somehow for this thing that can annihilate most of the major cities in the Soviet Union to be in a beautiful place like that. And of course, it automatically makes it a target by its very presence there. It makes a target out of a place that is very important to people who live in the Northwest. So I wrote this poem off Port Townsend the month before Trident. Down Harrow Strait in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, the killer whales would broach and roll, lifting tall dorsals free of the water, breath popping like steam valves on old boilers. Black and white they were, like a giant string quartet. Not vicious as we'd thought, but tameable and captive, aiming only to please. Once lonely sailors rocked from by their music through a ship's hull, mistook them for mermaids. Now, if you put your ear to the water, you might listen to the hiss of electrons, the turbine's deep nuclear hum, and pulse of propellers at each revolution, whispering no to the hope of cities. The morning I saw my first Poseidon, I forgot the salmon I had come to fish for, and rammed the throttle open, closing at 20 knots, quartering on its bow, my puny bend the Trident flag unfurled. From their high place, surrounded by periscopes, the curious officers looked down. I was no Bogart, my boat no African queen. I only wished to keep this Poseidon safe in some post-nuclear museum, a tame nose we might pat, disarming as the whales, but for now it holds course, which is darkened by its pace, staining the scenery it slips through like grease. Tacking from that wake, I bore toward a reef of gulls and auklets, candlefish and rising salmon. White sand cliffs where madronas start and whisper, blue sky, a red bell hanging on slack tide, the only black exposed rock, the whale's dorsal. Once there was a city-state that promised everything, white as the sand cliffs with olive trees, promenades framed in marble, and statues of the old cruel gods. Poseidon was one, his weapon the Trident, names we thought we could use because they meant nothing. And I'll end finally with a poem titled The Four Seasons. I've always loved Vivaldi's music, this poem may not have that much to do with Vivaldi, really. It started just one day looking out a window at a view. And it begins instead of in spring, in the winter. Somehow, this is not an intentional reference to go from a submarine poem to a submarine metaphor. It's really the way the frost looked on the window, the four seasons. In the shape of a submarine, frost lengthens on a window. Outside, winter sparrows perch in rhinoceros-colored trees. Mares' tails chase whitely past brick chimneys. I have seen those lights before, small rectangular eyes of far buildings, one church steeple darkening the blue sky. Looks like a stopped gray heart if hearts sport such delicate scallops and trees wear hearts on their sleeves. Now the first wasp of spring emerges, its wings a transparency of fish scales, old isinglass or vein-fretted windows, wings of the first untranscendent angel sentenced to death by the god frost. How can some later spring reclaim this paper city or repair its walls damaged in the long drop from the 120th odd year of a tree? The sky wears that color through which you expect a tornado's black drill. Only cicadas try the air, a scratching that cannon could not silence. Beyond the barn with three silos and the wind pump stopped like a tin daisy, carp lip the surface of reflective. Name this paper city or repair its walls damaged in the long drop from the 120th odd year of a tree. The sky wears that color through which you expect a tornado's black drill. Only cicadas try the air, a scratching that cannon could not silence. Beyond the barn with three silos and the wind pump stopped like a tin daisy, carp lip the surface of reflected sky, the promised violence. I always imagined that place as an orchard on a mountaintop, its summer delicious freckling to a sunset by Syrah. But the last time it was fall, the sere grass bent one way toward a gate, as though a great wind had swept down stones of the garden walls. Two posts bent where the orchard had been, their purpose obscure. They stood, I think, where flowers had rivaled deepest in their colors and scents. Thank you very much. Thank you.